PCJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehon.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, from PCJ Radio International. 2 weeks ago, we had a rather big typhoon, and today, as of the recording of this program, we also have another typhoon coming our way. In fact, we recorded the show a day earlier, just in case there were any sort of problems that could arise from it. Now, this typhoon is not making a direct hit to Taiwan, but it is also considered a Category 4 by the Central Weather Bureau. So it'll be bringing a lot of rain. And actually in the vicinity, well, when I mean vicinity, I mean Asia, there's also another typhoon which is making its way towards Japan. Also expected to make landfall in the next few days. The one that we're expecting to get is probably sometime within the next 72 hours of the recording of this program. So, before you start sending messages like, I hope you stay safe, and I hope everything's going to be okay, I'll tell you right now, everything is going to be okay. Really, it really is. You know, there's no need to panic. Time for music. Nat King Cole and Ramblin' Rose.
Ramblin' Rose.
Nat King Cole and Ramblin' Rose beginning today's edition of the program. If it does sound like I'm stuffed up, not stuffy, but a little bit stuffed up, that's because I had a I don't know, it was a cold that just sort of appeared out of nowhere and started vanishing 24 hours later. Fever and everything else. And now I'm sort of on the mend, as they say. I don't know what happened. It came really, really fast and then disappeared just as fast as it arrived. So some of the shows that I was recording this week was a little bit difficult because I felt like I should be doing commercials for cough medicine or something like that. But, as I mentioned earlier, there is another typhoon coming our way. And on this week's edition of Media Network Plus, we're going to be looking at what I like to call, and not just me, but also a number of other people, parachute journalists. Journalists that parachute into a place, stay for a few days, and then leave right after. And I only decided to do it this weekend because we have this other typhoon that is on our way. And after some of the reporting that was done on the last one, Sotelor, 2 weeks ago, I thought maybe we should give them a course on news gathering. I mean, they were making the most ridiculous mistakes, and I think you heard me mention it before, but tune into this week's edition of Media Network Plus and you'll see what I mean about the mistakes that were made. And we're also going to be joined on that program by Bruce Hill from Radio Australia's Pacific Beat program. And that's coming up on PCJ Radio International, wherever you may be and wherever partner station you're listening to our programs on. And if you want to hear them online, just go to www.pcjmedia.com and you'll see all the show pages on the right menu. Now time for the Taipei, that's right, the Taipei Symphony Orchestra playing Anton Dvořák's Symphony No. 9. The New World Symphony.
Thank you.
Taipei Symphony Orchestra playing Anton Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, the New World Symphony. And here in Taipei, the Taipei Symphony, actually, they've been around for quite a few number of years, actually. And classical music is very popular here in Taiwan. Every couple of years, the Berlin Philharmonic come to Taipei, and they perform at the National Theater, which is located near the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial Hall. Actually, it's part of the same park. And every time the Berlin Philharmonic come to Taipei, it is, we'll put it this way, they get sort of a rock star's welcome. And Simon Rattle, who's the current conductor, who's actually leaving, he's doing this last tour with them in Asia, and they're coming here. And the last time that they were here, he said himself that it was shocking. He never thought that, you know, they would have this kind of welcome. And they did. So it should be fun, and I'm planning to go see them a third time when they come here towards the end of the year. You're listening to Happy Station, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now time for a little bit of big band music, performed by the BBC Big Band, playing Song of the Volga Boatman. Thank you. BBC Big Band with the Song of the Volga Boatmen. It's now time to go into the archives with a program from Radio Nederland from 1972. This is for the Golden Windmill Contest that Radio Netherlands was doing. And the final, at the end of the contest, they did a series of radio programs for the top winners of the short story contest. And today we're going to listen to the first prize winner, which came from Nairobi. So let's go back in time.
In 1971, Radio Nederland organized a short story competition for African writers under 30 years of age. The first prize, a gold-plated model of a Dutch windmill and a trip to the Netherlands, was won by Rashid Baramossi of Nigeria with his story Sunset Over Nairobi. Eddie Williams will read it. Sunset Over Nairobi by Rashid Baramossi.
Walking towards downtown Nairobi reminded Ike of his innumerable walks in European cities. The air possessed a touch of spring, accentuating the dewy freshness of the city and the beautifully odd modernity that was Nairobi. The carriageway was tree-lined. Ike looked across and saw the bougainvillea flowers shimmering in the setting sunlight, the garden sloping up towards the trees that were perched on the rolling hills along the route to the game park. He realized the city was carved out of a virgin forest by European settlers for the settlers, because about 5 miles outside the city lay the natural habitat of wild animals, otherwise known as the Nairobi Game Reserve. In the shopping district, where all the trappings of a modern city, traffic policemen, tourists, hotels, coffee shops, and side street souvenir hawkers and supermarkets, then through the narrow streets towards the Indian bazaars that sold everything from American shirts to Chinese silk. Drinking joints abounded in the district, some small and dark, others spacious and embalzoned with the bright lights that went dimmer at night when the girls come dancing to Lingala Rumba, echoing through the cool unreality of the high-altitude city. Ike observed that most of the aliens were gone, and migrants from the countryside in search of the bright lights were not settled in downtown Nairobi, but in the mice-infected shanty environs, resigned to the many odds of modern life and the tensions of the city temple. Once, a clean-up campaign was planned, because the mayor announced that an epidemic threatened the city. So it was decided that the dwellers were to be forcibly evicted and the shacks burnt out. Hundreds of the shantytown residents lost their homes in the campaign. However, Ike had come to Nairobi in search of Victoria. The civil war was over in his native Nigeria, and Ike had planned to return home. He had received news about his family. His father, a retired judge, was dead. But because he had felt a particular episode of his years abroad could not be completed without concluding the interlude with Victoria, Ike had changed his flight schedule at London Airport and boarded a plane for Nairobi. He had met Victoria on a bus one grey, drizzly day in Manchester, England. She didn't have small change to pay her fare, and the bus conductor had expressed apologies that he couldn't break a pound note. Ike had been sitting three rows ahead of her, and he had turned round once to see the black young woman in distress about paying the correct bus fare. The thought had flickered through his mind that he might offer help, but he had quickly forgotten it, since in the land of the English, everyone was supposed to mind his own business. But then there had been a gentle tap on his shoulder, and turning round, he had seen the pretty oval face of a petite Zulu dame, the eyes glowing in tenderness and resilience. "I am sorry to bother you," Victoria had started. "I find it rather embarrassing, but could you lend me a sixpence? I must get off at the next stop, and I have just a pound note." "Oh, that's all right. You can pay my fare next time," Ike had smiled and given her the sixpence. "Oh, thank you. I'd like to pay you back, though. Where can I find you?" "Department of Anthropology at the university." "That's good. I am in dentistry. I'll look you up. Thanks again, and goodbye." "Goodbye." At lunchtime the next day, Ike had wearily stepped out of a seminar class, and he had been rather surprised to find Victoria standing against a wall in the corridor. "Hello," she had cheerfully said. "I thought I'd return your sixpence." "You really shouldn't have bothered," Ike had told her. "I like paying my debts," she had said. "What? A sixpence? Well, it's enough to buy you a cup of tea." "Well, why don't you join me for a cup of tea then? Or perhaps lunch?" "Have you had lunch?" Ike inquired. "No." "Would you have lunch with me?" he asked. "I think I might," Victoria answered. "Where shall we go?" "You choose," she had conceded. "Well, let me see," said Ike with a thoughtful expression on his face. "Where does one go after having read a paper on accusation of witchcraft, a means of social control in Africa?" "Ah, bah, you've been studying witchcraft? You must be hungry." "I am rather," Ike smiled. "Well, let's go to Annie's restaurant. That's where I think we should go too." The lunch had led to a Saturday night at the cinema, and then to other dates, and finally to a quiet whisper from Ike that they be engaged on her next birthday in the spring of 67. Victoria had asked for time to write her parents in Kenya about it. Meanwhile, the civil war had broken out in Nigeria. As the war escalated, the affair had meant a source of emotional stability for Ike. But he had changed his mind one day about any romantic entanglement, perhaps due to the blackout of news about his family in the war zone, and he had told Victoria so. Victoria had felt disappointed, and she too had banished the thoughts of Ike from her life. She returned to her family's adopted domicile in Kenya, the first female dental surgeon in the new republic. Unaware that he had walked in this direction, Ike found himself in front of his hotel. Earlier in the day, he had combed the hospitals in the city, inquiring about Victoria Kiwala. At the General Hospital, he had been told Victoria had once worked there, but had lately been transferred to Nakuru. At the next hospital, her name had rung a bell, and they had wondered if she were the dental surgeon that had left a few weeks ago to join the Flying Doctor service. Yet, at another, she had been seen saying goodbye to a young doctor at 11 o'clock that morning, and that the young doctor had been noticed shaking his head in obvious melancholy as he walked down the hospital corridor. So now Ike entered the hotel, and after a quick shower and a change of clothes, he stepped into the refreshing nightfall of the high elevation city. He hailed a taxi and asked the driver to take him to the most reputable night spot in the city. Settling down to a drink, Ike looked around the club, and as he slowly sipped his drink, he tried to think about what it would be like in his home country since he left it 10 years ago. The Civil War had come and gone, leaving him with the twisted emotions that saw the end of hostilities as a relief, and yet plunged him into mourning on account of his dead father, and also the uncertainties of life in the war-scared country. Now, in the club in Kenya, there were many Kenyan girls sitting round the bar, and there were many white Kenyans and tourists sitting alone at their tables. Nigeria, Ike thought, seemed so far away. Soon the band struck with a sweet Congolese rumba. The men got up and engaged the girls in the inimitable rhythmic dancing. In Ike's frame of mind, everything smacked of routine laughter and superficial abandon, and he might as well have been elsewhere. When the music was over, Ike observed that many of the girls were seated with the men. Racial harmony, he thought. Yes, that's the optimistic note of social anthropology. Racial integration in Kenya after the emergency. Wasn't Kenya once called the land of Mau Mau? Perhaps I should return here some day as a visiting professor and do research on the subject. But he hadn't come for deep thinking. The web of emotions tangled in him involved Victoria and his return home. It had nothing to do with human races. He finished his drink, and his head was sharp and clear. He was heading past the incoming guests at the door when, in his utter disbelief, he saw Victoria in an evening dress, escorted by a white man. For a moment, Ike and Victoria were transfixed and speechless. "Ike!" Victoria then exclaimed. "Fancy meeting you here." "Victoria, you at last," Ike said. "Ike, I'd like you to meet Dr. Hutton. He's a Canadian attached to the Flying Doctor service. We work together. And this is Ike Egbunike, a Nigerian. We were contemporaries at the University of Manchester." "How do you do?" said Ike, extending his hand. "Hi," the Canadian said, shaking Ike's hand. "Are you leaving so early?" Victoria asked Ike. "Well, yes. I'd in fact checked you up at all the hospitals in the city," Ike replied, eyeing the Canadian doctor. "Where are you staying?" "I am at the Ambassador." "All right, I'll find you. When are you leaving Nairobi?" "Tomorrow evening." "I'll see you before your departure." "Good night, then." "Bye." "Good night, Dr. Hutton." The morning after the brief encounter found Ike anxious and on edge. The afternoon made him unduly nervous, and at noon he gave up window shopping in the city centre, and he took a long nap at the hotel. He woke up at 4 and rushed to inquire at the receptionist if he had had a visitor at all. Disappointed, he started to pack his baggage for the evening's flight. It was curious how his mind had accommodated the fact that Victoria's escort the previous night had been a Canadian. For Victoria, in spite of her charm and wit, was surely sensitive about the race relations in her native South Africa, especially since her family had had to flee the country when she was 4 years old. At 5 o'clock, the telephone operator announced a lady visitor. It was Victoria. "I'd almost given you up," Ike told her. "I said I'd come," Victoria replied. "Where is Dr. Hutton?" Oh, he's on duty at the base hospital this evening. Why? Nothing. Shall we go to the bar? Yes, certainly. They drank in silence for a moment, and then they took refuge in the exchange of some pleasantries about Nairobi's prettiness, Swahili, and the weather. Victoria, in dead earnestness, had once given him lessons in Swahili, but he had gradually forgotten as the memories of her receded in intensity. Presently, Ike came to the point. Victoria, I've come all the way to look for you. I know. What do you know? He asked, surprised at her directness. I know you still want me, Victoria said. Don't you want me? I did at a time. And you don't now? I'd rather think not. Why? I don't know. Seeking to change the subject, Victoria inquired after the health of his family. I lost my father during the war, in an accident. He stepped on a landmine, and my old mother is living with my sister's family in our town. I'm sorry to hear that. How is your family? My parents have settled on a farm at Nakuru. They are country people now. They are Kenyan citizens, aren't they? Ike asked. Yes, but I'm sure they still dream of the day they'll return to South Africa. We all have this dream, you know. It's nice to return home. I'm going home now. I wish you could come with me. It might make everything all right. That's highly unlikely, Victoria said. Why? So many influences have worked on me since those days in England, Ike. I don't see why that could affect... Ike, Victoria cut in. You should understand. Remember, you called it off because your mind was unsettled by the war in your country? Yes. I couldn't comprehend it at first, but then I accepted. Right now, I think I understand. What do you understand, Victoria? The feeling of ruthlessness and unstable emotions. Nairobi, although incongruous, is pleasant and all that. But you see, Ike, it isn't exactly home. That's got little to do with you and me. It has everything, Ike. You and I were strangers in England, and we naturally shared a common experience. You are going home now, and I am still a stranger. It makes my life uncertain, Ike. Everything is so unpredictable. If you'd come with me, though, we can... That's not the solution, Victoria interrupted. I am too restless now to make firm commitments to anyone. What about Dr. Hutton, the Canadian? You must be joking, Victoria smiled. I think he must have been lonely last night, and when he asked me out, I was confused for a while, but then I accepted. It was purely platonic. I mean, he might ask me out tomorrow, and I'll give him an excuse and say no. Do you have anyone in mind now? Not particularly. I can't see your logic, Victoria. Victoria stood up. Some things are just inexplicable. I got all the letters you sent from England, and each time I wanted to write you back. But I thought it wouldn't help. I must go now, Ike. For a moment, Ike said nothing as he lost himself in a faraway reflection. I could have taken the direct flight to Lagos from London, Victoria, he finally managed to say. That might have been better. Perhaps I didn't have the courage, Victoria, but you don't have to rub it in. I am sorry, Ike. I must go. I am meeting someone at 7. So that's the routine for life now. I have no choice, Ike, really. I must go. You do that, Ike told her. Anything else you want to say? No. Or shall I see you off at the airport then? You needn't bother. Goodbye then. Goodbye. Ike sat still, and he felt the muscles of his stomach tighten. Victoria strided across to the glass door, and looking up, Ike caught the aging sunlight bounce off the glass and traced the look of sad resignation on her face. A gentle, cool breeze blew in through the door. Ike heaved a deep breath, and the knot inside him loosened. On the jet plane, a stewardess served him a drink and said something to him in Swahili. "I tried to learn that language once," Ike said. "But now, I've lost all the desire." He was sleeping all the way to Lagos.
Eddie Williams read Sunset Over Nairobi, a short story by Rashid Badamossi, which won him the first prize in Radio Nederland's Golden Windmill Contest, 1971.
One of the programs from the Golden Windmill Contest, actually the first prize winner, and we got that from our archives. If you want to hear another vintage program from the Radio Netherlands archives, I know that many of you do, and some of you say, well, we want to hear a bit of Eddie Starter, Tom Meyer, now and again. Well, we have actually some of that coming up very soon, so stay tuned. All right, time for music again. Here is Alison Moyet and Weak in the Presence of Beauty. Moya Week in the Presence of Beauty. This week I was reading a very interesting article, and they were talking about the difference between analog and digital recording. Now, while it's true that tape in a recording studio is not used as widely as maybe as it was 30 years ago. Surprisingly, a lot of musicians still record on analog tape before they do a final mix down to digital. Apparently, it gives a very, very different sound. The article also went on to saying that the problem now is the lack of engineers that are able to work correctly with the analog format. And it was kind of funny because I remember this same thing. Well, actually, it wasn't too long ago, but I was I don't remember where it was now. I remember. It was a pressing plant that I went to see a number of years ago. And most of the equipment that's used in pressing plants today goes back to the 1950s. And the same thing with the lathes that they use to cut the masters to press the discs. That's all technology from the 50s, and some of the equipment from the 50s is still being used. And it was one pressing plant that I went to, and it was rather interesting. The guy that was actually making the master disc was 82, working on equipment from the 50s, and he was pressing a rap song to a 12-inch single. You know, and I said, what do you think of the music you're pressing? And he said, I've been doing this job 60 years, and I have heard everything you can imagine. And I am not surprised. Hello, Dolly! Bobby Darin.
Hello, Dolly. Well, hello, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You're looking swell, Dolly, and I can tell, Dolly, you still crowing, you still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying while the band's playing one of your old favorite songs from way back when. So take her rap, fellas, find her an empty lap, fellas, and Dolly will never go away again. I said hello, Dolly, well, what do you know, Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You're looking swell, Dolly, and I can tell, Dolly, you're still crowing, you're still growing, you're still going strong. Just feel that room swaying, 'cause the band's playing one of your old familiar songs from way back when. So, golly gee, fellas, find her an empty knee, fellas, and Dolly will never go. Dolly, what do you know, Dolly? It's so nice to have you back where you belong. I can tell, Dolly, you're looking swell, swell, Dolly. Yeah, you're still growing, you're still growing, you're still going strong. Just feel that room swaying while the band keeps on playing one of your old familiar songs from way back when. So, golly gee, fellas, have a little faith in me, fellas, and Dolly will never go away again. Just feel that room swaying while that band is playing one of your old familiar songs from way back when. So,
Bobby Darin and Hello, Dolly. Well, we're nearly out of time. If you want to contact us, our email address is pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. We're going to leave you today with Rodriguez, or Sixto Rodriguez, or Sugar Man, as he's nicknamed, with the song Can't Get Away. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
In the troubled city, in rock and roll USA, in the shadow of the tallest building, I vowed I would break away. Listen to the Sunday actors, but all they would ever say, that you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away. No, you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away. School down the city sidewalks, coldness at every turn. Knew I had to find the exits, I never ever would return. Scoffed at the prophet's omens that said I would live to learn that you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away. No, you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away. Coast, stopped in a sleepy town, left my change and walked out, I didn't even turn around. What they were getting next time was that old familiar sound that you can't get away from. No, you can't get away. No, you can't get away from. No, you can't get away. In a hotel room in Amsterdam, on a wild and windy August night, as a cloud passed over a cold moon, my heart was seized with terror and fright. Seeping up through the floorboards, coming in through the walls, coming in through the doorway, ringing up and down the halls. That you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away. No, you can't get away from it. No, you can't get away.